Now, as you remember, as we started out this section of the course, we were concerned with the consciousness of time and the way this was related both to the formation of the ego and its identity, and the way the consciousness of time in history affects our consciousness of historical change and such large-scale transformations as the Industrial Revolution. And then we moved up to consider history as a weapon and the way in which historians themselves, in reconstituting the past in totally different ways and in opposed groups, as for example in the history of the Enclosure Acts, use history as a weapon, and that kind of time was supposed to be very scientific, can itself become a political ideology, even when the historians themselves are trying to be explicitly scientific and feel that they have no axe to grind and no bias whatsoever. They're still very much rooted in the historical moment, and history becomes a political weapon. And then we moved on to consider history and the consciousness of history as it's reflected in art and the changing ideas of nature in the history of painting from the Middle Ages to the 20th century, and how different consciousnesses of nature in science interact and connect with the ideas of nature in painting. What I want to talk about tonight then is art and historical consciousness, but focusing on literature and the way in which literature constitutes and creates the consciousness of history and begins to affect larger issues such as national identity. If we focus on the idea of history in the 18th century, in people like Hume and others before him, history was pretty much seen as the biography of great men. Since history was basically being written by an elite, a literate, upper class consensus of the aristocratic vision of history, then history pretty much was the effect of great men, from the Pericles funeral oration all the way up. And so you had pretty much the sense of the monumental approach to history. History was an excuse for building a monument. History was what great soldiers did. History was the achievement of great lawgivers. And it was pretty much an elitist vision that the biography of the great really constituted what history was all about. There was no real sense of history in terms of classes, economics, social contradictions. It was pretty much the narrative history of the biography of heroes. So in those days you could say, according to Marx's ideas, that history expressed a false consciousness. It expressed the false consciousness of an elite and tended to rationalize their position, and was pretty much the way they looked at time. So it was sort of the general internal tension in history was like noble ideas versus kind of diabolic schemes, and it was the Shakespearean vision of history. If you take a look at Shakespeare's history plays, this presents the kind of relationship between the grand vision and the kind of diabolical scheme going on in the sort of Richard II kind of vision. Heroes, battles, conspiracies, murder, and all of that. When you come to Maria Edgeworth Castle Rackrent in 1800, a new sensibility is coming in, and a change in this point of view is slowly coming forth. And if you consider that kind of four-step creative process that I talked about in Passages About Earth, that innovation occurs in a kind of cycle where first crazies and then artists and then scientists and finally pedants move in on ideas. You can see that the science that's coming into Europe as a response to the Industrial Revolution, namely the social sciences, which are a way of understanding this mammoth change that destroys Christian civilization and introduces a new commercial civilization, that the understanding and analysis of this change comes not first with Durkheim or first with Marx, it comes first with the historical novel, and by which you can say it comes first with Maria Edgeworth, since Maria Edgeworth is the one that Sir Walter Scott points to as being really the fountainhead of this genre, that she is the creator of the historical novel, and he was simply working in the genre that she had formulated. So that before the kind of regional novels of the Russians, it's Maria Edgeworth who is beginning to explore the idea of regional identity and historical change. It's interesting that it would come in Ireland, because, of course, Ireland is very much one of the, as we'll see in the coming weeks, is a country that was at the interface between industrialization and rural feudal civilization, and the country that suffered the most from being in that perilous position. So that Ireland was in a kind of unique position to feel the kind of change and be the place to stand to observe it. And she was another one of these interface phenomena kind of people, because she wasn't Catholic and she wasn't pure Irish. She was of the Protestant landlord class. She was a member of the aristocracy. And so living in a foreign country, living as a stranger in a strange land, she would have the ideal perspective of the artist to look on at the change and understand the whole kind of contradictions of the feudal vision of reality right at the point that it's vanishing. So she is not only at the interface between class structures as an aristocrat, as a Protestant in a Catholic land, but she's at the interface between the two countries, Ireland and England, and she's writing right at the interface between the two centuries of the 18th and the 19th century, seeing one world vanish and another world come in. So the historical novel is really beginning to create the analysis of social conditions and class ideas before the social sciences and preceding the rise of modern economic theory. So if you remember Whitehead said in Science in the Modern World, that the artist first analyzed nature and was involved in the meticulous examination of nature that we saw when we were looking at that picture by Bellini on St. Francis in Ecstasy. And then the scientist began to be involved with that same kind of empiricism. But the artist was really functioning as the pioneer and the explorer and moving into new terrain. And then he was followed by the scientist, and the artistic was made thoroughly rational. This, again, is the case when we come to literature. It's the novelist who is going forth, exploring new terrain, looking at social classes, being concerned with contradictions, beginning to think in economic terms, and it will be the Durkheims and the Marxes and the Engels who will follow 50 years or so later and try to codify that into sociology. So economics is really very much a concern of the regional and historical novel. In some ways, you can say that the novel as a genre is very much about economics. Dorothy Van Ghent has written on the role of money in the English novel and how very much an important theme it is. So if you consider, say, bourgeois success, the rise of the lower classes into the middle classes, that bourgeois success and the bourgeois success story is really the novel, and that this theme of middle class success is very important in Moll Flanders in the 18th century and becomes a dominant theme of the novel in the 19th century with things like Great Expectations. So that in those novels, we see the autobiography of the middle classes as they rise from their lower station to success and take part in a whole new expanding world. In this particular novel, in the historical novel, we're seeing the other side of that same economic phenomenon, the failure of the aristocracy and the collapse of the feudal order and the general failure of nerve of the aristocracy, the inability of the aristocrats to seize their moment, understand their time, and leap forth into a new age, the failure of imagination that causes them to close in upon one vision of history to try and make that period of time last forever, much as we might say the industrialists of today are unable to leap across the void and can't understand the new non-industrial culture emerging, and so they're barricading themselves farther and farther into a corner and putting themselves in a position where we may have the same thing on a global scale, just a cataclysmic failure of nerve and failure of the aristocracy, generating all the kind of turmoil and change that came in with the failure of the aristocracy in the 19th century. Now, once again, with this vision of failure, which is a very important theme in Irish literature by itself, we see this continuing phenomenon of the sunset effect, that right as an age or an order is about to perish, that's the time it finds its most comprehensive expression. So as the aristocracy is about to disappear in a lonely sort of godforsaken backwater country like Ireland, where feudalism is lingering on in sort of primitive way, much as it might in Russia or Poland, that's where it's beginning to be expressed artistically, and that's where the vanishing of the feudal order finds its ultimate form. When we focus on this idea of the failure of the feudal order in the novel, we can see that what's being described is the sort of the first step from the transition from a Christian to a commercial civilization, and the collapse of the tragic vision of the fall, in which time is here and all of it goes downhill, downward and downward into sin, and perdition, to a new kind of line where things go from the Dark Ages and papistry upward into economic development and enlightenment, and the shift from the Christian vision of things to the liberal vision, which is a shift from the religious, the religio-mythic vision of history to the liberal economic vision of history. And as this step comes in from moving from Christian to commercial civilization, the actual commercialization is coming from the landlords themselves as they begin to modernize agriculture, introduce all kinds of improvements on the land, and try to bring in industrial values into the running of a farm. But the first sort of failures are the failures for them to be responsible to the kind of web of interrelatedness. The Christian vision is basically the chain of being and the order, the natural order of things, so that when the Queen Elizabeth would come in procession into the city of London, the Cockney Lord Mayor would greet her and welcome her into the city and say, "You are the Queen in your particular position in heaven, but I am the Mayor of London and I have my position, and we meet as fellow human beings." And there was an understanding that everything was in its place and had its correspondence with other things. And so the whole universe was a system of correspondences and planes of being, so that the rose was correspondent as the best flower, as the queen would be correspondent to the best in human principles. So the whole vision of the medieval order is a vision of interconnectedness, a web of being, that the peasant and the squire or the lord go to church together, and in a small country kirk, they sit down together and they worship God together. Now the laird may have his own pew and may sit in the front, but he sees the poor and he knows them, and they are his people, and they have been working on his estate for time immemorial and for generations into the darkness of time. So there is a sense of responsibility. They're his people. If a failure of the crop should come, then he has to somehow tidy them over and give out food from his stores or money or cash and see them through the crisis, because it's the sense of obligation. It is the noblesse oblige, the aspect that those who are chosen by God to be the best and to be the privileged few to rule therefore have a responsibility to serve those who are beneath them. And the idea of aristocracy is not necessarily built upon a vision of dehumanization and mercantilism and translating everything into a cash value. So that when the land, which was seen as kind of living, and even if you look at, say, medieval poems like Summer is a Coming In, you can see the whole peasant description is the fructifying power of nature and the explosions of spring that touch the animals and the trees and the rest of it. When that vision begins to go, the shift, as early as the 16th century, is a movement in England to produce food for a cash crop. And you translate nature, this force, this spirit, into abstractions. And you produce food not to feed your body or to feed your children or to feed the nation, but to feed the economic system of Europe that's emerging, so that in the 16th century the modern world system comes into being, a new economy begins to involve all the nations into a world economy, and England begins to produce food as a cash crop. And this is an enormously profound change that Emmanuel Wallerstein has described in his book on the modern world system. And it involves a change of perception, a change of worldview, a different way of looking at nature. If you look at nature and you see dollar signs or pound sterling, you're not seeing nature in the traditional peasant sort of way. And you're translating from one value into another. And a whole grid is being superimposed upon nature that is going to be very different from the grid that the medieval man or the Renaissance man had superimposed on nature when he saw it in terms of the planes of being and the great chain of being and the planes of correspondence. So the shift then comes about through the modernization of agriculture, the introduction of the ideas of the cash crop, and the change in which the landlord begins to look at his farm as if it were a factory. And therefore, if the factory begins to fail, or the peasants fail, it's like a machine breaking down. And when a machine breaks down, you just simply replace it and get another one. So you have a way in which you move into what became like the Highland clearances or the clearances in Ireland. You can see this in Maria Edgeworth's novel as she's talking about the way the landlords begin to run the farm as a factory, not as someone there all the time, looking over the land, concerned for the land, working with the peasants, walking into the fields and seeing his men and getting a sort of two-fingered salute you still can get in Ireland, but slowly changing to be a manager, a production expert, and more often than not, a man so concerned with turning food into a cash crop and so concerned in that system of abstractions that just as he removes himself from nature and turns it into cash, he removes himself from his farm and goes and lives with society in the watering places in Bath and or moving into London and just collects his rent. And so the people and the produce are simply seen as economic abstractions, and he begins to be what's called an absentee landlord. He's never there, and he's only concerned to get as much as he can from the farm. So the way that Maria describes this is in the mind of Taddy, the peasant, and sees this kind of whole description of the vices of absentee landlordism. Bad news still for the poor tenants, no change still for the better with them. Sir Kit Stopgap, my young master, left all to the agent, and though he had the spirit of a prince and lived away to the honor of his country abroad, which I was proud to hear of, what were we the better for that at home? The agent was one of your middlemen who grind the face of the poor and can never bear a man with a hat upon his head. He ferreted the tenants out of their lives, not a week without a call for money, drafts upon drafts from Sir Kit. But I laid it all to the fault of the agent, for, says I, what can Sir Kit do with so much cash, and he a single man? But still it went. Rents must be all paid up to the day and afore. No allowance for improving tenants, no consideration for those who had built upon their farms. No sooner was a lease out, but the land was advertised to the highest bidder. All the old tenants turned out, when they had spent their substance in the hope and trust of a renewal from the landlord. All was now set at the highest penny to a parcel of poor wretches who meant to run away and did so after taking two crops out of the ground. But I walked about thinking, if his honor, Sir Kit, long may he live to reign over us, knew all this, it would go hard with him, but he'd see us righted. Now this is almost the eternal lament of the peasant. One of the most surprising things about peasant revolutions, Eric Hobsbawm is as described in his studies of peasant revolt and banditry, is that peasant insurrections often have no social sense of class problems or any economic awareness, that even in the act of revolution they affirm the social order, so that they're incredibly what a Marxist would say very reactionary, so that they would say if the landlord only knew it would go hard for him but he'd see us righted, so that they look to the king or the queen or to their leader and believe that he is a leader, believe he should rule, that it is part of the natural order designed by God, and that if the landlord knew, he would go and eliminate the middleman and get rid of this agent. The agent is the land agent who's collecting the rent and mailing it off to the landlord in London or in Bath. So that the peasant doesn't see that it's the absentee landlord who is creating the structure, and that the middleman, the land agent, is running the thing because the landlord doesn't want to have any part and couldn't care at all about a mob of peasants in a primitive backwater land like Ireland, and wants to just enjoy society and all the best people in London. So there's this primitive quality and a failure to really analyze the whole connectedness of the new economic system, precisely because the peasant doesn't understand the new economic system. And so he hopes to look for revolution from the right rather than from the left. This is a case that occurs over and over and over again, even as late as the 19th century in Canada, when Louis Riel, who was a half Indian, half white Métis, organized his revolution in Manitoba. He put up the British flag and was invoking the Queen against the Ontario Protestants, and was looking to the Queen to help him effect the revolution, and saw himself as a loyal subject of the throne and not as a revolutionary. So there's often a case in which especially peasant revolutions tend to be surprisingly reactionary. So here's a whole system in which the agent is a middleman, and like a bureaucrat, he becomes extremely oppressive and lacking the social class and station of the aristocrat, he begins to ape all his manners and becomes intoxicated with power and becomes a kind of petty dictator. Not bound by the old traditions of noblesse oblige, he's a kind of man on the make, and often enough is just a peasant, as you see in this novel, is a peasant who's moved up one station and is now collecting the rent rather than paying the rent, and is enjoying lording it over the folk. So what happens as this new avaricious, greedy middle class emerges between peasant and landlord at either end of the scale is that there's a shift in consciousness, and the old idea of the folk becomes transformed into the new idea of the productive class, who are really cogs in a machine or interchangeable parts. And when you have a part that breaks down, you simply throw it away and you get another one. So when a crop fails, you get clearances in which you just scrape all the peasants off the land and bring in a whole new bunch. And as Marie Edgeworth is describing through Taddy, the new peasants obviously don't have any sense of permanence, because they can see that they're just being changed out and moved in and thrown away, so that they let the estates go down, the cottages wear away, they just scrape a living, try to get two cash crops off the land, and then move on. So you have this kind of shifting population that hasn't yet, especially in Ireland, moved into the cities to become the industrial proletarian class of Birmingham and Manchester, and they wander around the landscape belonging to no place, having no roots in any one area, and becoming a very alienated, disassociated group of people. So that the whole aspect of this economic system is it encourages that, because if you make improvements on your land, it's not going to be your land anymore, because it'll all be taken away from you. So the idea of clearances is part of the economic landscape of the 18th and 19th century. This is from The History of the Famine, The Great Hunger, by Cecil Wyndham Smith. Evictions, however, were not confined to populations of paupers and squatters living in mud huts. The most notorious instance was the eviction of 300 tenants by Mrs. Gerard from the village of Ballinglass, County Galway, on March 13, 1846. A population, reasonably prosperous according to Irish standards, was evicted with the assistance of police and troops in order that the holdings might be turned into a grazing farm. So again, just as in the Highland clearances, when they wanted to get rid of the scruffy peasantry and introduce sheep and grazing and cattle, the idea was to move from traditional agriculture and the medieval estate to economic agriculture and what is affectionately called by liberals modernization. The village of Ballinglass consisted of 61 houses, solidly built and well-kept with thick plastered walls. The inhabitants were not in arrear with their rent and had by their industry reclaimed an area of about 400 acres from a neighboring bog. On the morning of the eviction, a large detachment of the 49th Infantry, commanded by Captain Brown, and numerous police appeared with the sheriff and his men. Taking part in evictions was disliked by troops. A little later, on April 9th, at an eviction of 9 families in Gitmore, County Tipperary, a detachment of the 72nd Highlanders openly said they detested this duty and gave the people money. At Ballinglass, the people were officially called on to give up possession, and the houses were then demolished, roofs torn off, walls thrown down. The scene was frightful. Women running, wailing with pieces of their property and clinging to doorposts from which they had to be forcibly torn. Men cursing, children screaming with fright. That night, the people slept in the ruins. Next day, they were driven out. The foundations of the houses were torn up and razed, and no neighbor was allowed to take them in. So this climaxed in the Irish famine, but the whole process that's coming on in Ireland is still seen as early as 1800 and had been going on even before that. So what you have, in a sense, is this frictional interface between two worlds, and the peasants getting caught between the grinding machinery of the wheels of time and just getting torn apart, and the whole sense that there's no way to understand it because the people on opposite sides of this interface are looking at reality with totally different worldviews. So the thing that one needs to understand is the way economics is related to the ethnocentrism of a particular worldview, and it has to be seen in terms of the transformation of worldview. A very interesting book that's been written on this particular problem in economics is by Karl Polanyi on the Great Transformation, the Political and Economic Origins of Our Time. And he's very much concerned with the idea of the market system and how it arose, and in many ways has written about this in ways that Wallerstein has continued. And he talks about the implications of moving away from the Christian vision to the labor market and what this does to perception. This effect of the establishment of a labor market is conspicuously apparent in colonial regions today. The natives are to be forced to make a living by selling their labor. To this end, their traditional institutions must be destroyed and prevented from reforming, since, as a rule, the individual in a primitive society is not threatened by starvation unless the community as a whole is in a like predicament. Now, notice the ironies of that. In a primitive society, of course, you don't have starvation because people share, so that you have to improve primitive society to the point that you can introduce the spur of starvation. Ironically, the white man's initial contribution to the black man's world mainly consisted in introducing him to the uses of the scourge of hunger. Thus, the colonists may decide to cut the breadfruit trees down in order to create an artificial food scarcity, or may impose a hut tax on the native to force him to barter away his labor. In either case, the effect is similar to that of Tudor enclosures with their wake of vagrant hordes. Now, what you have, of course, is that in primitive society, where they don't understand economic values and can't look and translate time into linear clock time and can't translate nature into the source of cash crops and productivity, they only work to sustain themselves. And if they can make a living wage in 2 hours' work, they quit after 2 hours. They're not going to hang around in a factory for 8 hours a day or 12 hours or 14 hours trying to make all this kind of money. So what they had to do was continually lower their wages so that whatever it is they thought they needed, that they once earned in 2 hours, they had to work 12 or 14 hours. So it was very necessary to forcibly alter their worldview and to forcibly try to bring them into the modern world. Now, this kind of economics is just the antithesis of Stone Age economics. In Stone Age economics and in primitive communities, you have the idea of economic reciprocity. Once again, the worldview is such that all of nature is seen as a living, interpenetrating field of oneness. And everything in that field touches everything else. So that if you are hungry and you have food, need food, someone else who has food will give it to you because they feel that bread cast upon the waters will return to you, and that there will be another time when you'll need it, and your friend or your tribal kinsman will give it to you. So there's this scene in the movie by John Marshall in The Hunters that describes the way in which the economic system of reciprocity works. You come to a water well, it's in some particular tribal territory, you ask permission to drink the water, not because you need permission, but it's just a courtesy. Permission is always given. When they finally shoot the giraffe or lancet, they bring the food back to the weir, and then you can see the structure of society thrown into visible relief as you see the way the food is circulated. And it goes to the old people and the people who were not in the hunt as a kind of ceremonial gesture, because next time you won't be in the hunt and somebody's going to bring in food, and so you'll want it. So the primitive people aren't like children saying, "Give me, it's mine, and no, you can't have any of my chocolate." They're perfectly willing to share, and they know that the whole system of caring and sharing is what human society is all about. So primitive economics are ironically, from a moral point of view, very advanced indeed. Part of the aspect of reciprocity is, of course, there is no sense of classes. When you shift into civilized values and you break up into classes, then there is separation between the classes, and there is not oneness, and there is not caring and sharing. There is the idea of private property and separateness. So all in all, what's going on in the transformation of worldview and in the shift of modes of perception to educate people in the realities of the modern world is, as it touches Ireland especially, a catastrophic change that results in the Irish famine and the death of 2 million people. And I'll spend more time on the famine a little later. In England, the clearances and the enclosures the process of overpopulation by itself led to urbanization, and the people, the vagrant hordes from Tudor times up to the 18th century, were wandering over the landscape and moved into the cities. And the the cities began to become the magnet and drew them off and put them into the workshops. So there was a kind of process of urbanization and proletarianization. The new middle class, in a sense, create the factories and the workshops, and they bring the wandering hordes into the factories, and there, ironically, the workers look around and recognize that something new has just occurred in history. There's a working class. They can look around the factory and say, we are the workers. There's no such thing as a proletarian in rural society, because everything is so unified and the people are worshiping in the same church, that the integral unity of being is such that the class consciousness is affected by, enforced by education, but even in the education there's a whole Christian sense that this has noblesse oblige and obligations and duties and responsibilities. When you move into the other aspect of urbanization, then the classes are cut off from one another, and the newly mobile middle class, acting like the petty bureaucrats, begin to take on a power that they revel in, because they're trying to fight the aristocracy. And so the middle class begins to exert its power in the best way they can by those under them. So notice even in the novel how Taddy reinforces the class distinctions. He doesn't think in terms of a proletarian or a worker. He always talks about the history of the family and says, but I didn't mention it in front of the other servants because I didn't want them to know about it, and it wasn't right. It's a secret for himself, and the servants reconstitute the social structure in miniature, because the butler and the domestic servants are considered the aristocracy and not just the dumb peasants and the field hands, so that they will sit at table, and the inferior servants will wait upon the head butler, and he will set himself up in the kitchen and act like a lord. So Taddy is considering himself in a very privileged position, and he doesn't want the others to know, so he reinforces the whole social structure and thinks the social structure is a pretty good thing. Now, in the shift in Ireland with this this economic system that results in the famine, you have a strange thing going on whereby the rise of the middle class is not as powerful and as rapid and as effective in urbanization as it was in England. For some reason, Ireland does not urbanize as much, perhaps because it exports so much of its people, perhaps because the 2 million died. But the introduction of middle class values was very slow and very resistant, and the whole myth of from rags to riches did not become a dominant mythology among the Irish. The dominant mythology is that the poor boy or the poor peasant becomes a priest if he makes it. And so the peasant hopes somehow to save enough so that his boy in a head school will learn enough Latin and learn enough to read that he can finally achieve the greatest success of all, he can become a priest. So there begins to be this kind of union of the peasant and the priest against the Protestant landlord aristocracy, and not the rise of a middle class against the aristocracy, but a re-emphasis of Catholic culture, which is oral culture, and not the Protestant ethic, the Bible, and the spirit of capitalism. So the poor boy becomes a priest, not a burgher or a millionaire. Hence education, especially, as you'll see in Carlton as you read him, education is oral. The hedge school is taught out in the boondocks from the 17th century when to teach was a crime against the crown, and to be a priest was a capital offense, and you got a bounty if you brought in the head of a priest, so that the peasants tended to revere their priests in opposition to the English penal laws. But since schools were outlawed and education was considered an offense against the Protestant landlord class, education remained oral. It wasn't print, it wasn't books. Protestants had the Bible, and the Bible was important, but the church said the Bible's too dangerous for the average Catholic to read, and they don't spend much time on it. The church is based on the tactile sacraments and upon the word of the priest, and it's all oral culture, and so it's a radically different sensibility. So the Bible, printed information in the Bible, printed information in money, the Protestant ethic, the spirit of capitalism, industrialization, urbanization, all of these are not Irish, all of these are not feudal, all of these are not medieval, and they don't really touch the outlying areas. So the Catholic countries are medieval and oral and non-industrial, whether they're Portugal or Spain or Ireland. Catholic countries are always primitive, non-industrial places. So education has a very different impact upon the consciousness of the Irish. Now, universal mass education is another industrial phenomenon, which we'll see very clearly described in Charles Dickens' Hard Times, which is coming up in a couple of weeks. Mass education, when children worked on the farms, labor was considered as natural as birth or death or old people. It was part of the order of things that children could work on the farms. When industrialization came in and children proved to be very ineffective workers in factories, then something had to be done with them, so they were taken out of the factories and you began to get schools, and schooling became another way of collectivizing, so that the school system became a collectivizing instrument or institution, much in the way that the factory was. So in Ireland, when you don't have this kind of universal mass education, you still have a strong dependence on oral teaching and the head school. So in pre-industrial culture, no one really thinks very much of child labor. The paradox of child labor and the problems that it created come up much later in the age of rising expectations, and come up in the 1830s when they're passing the laws against child labor and changing the workday from about 12 hours a day down to 10. All in all, what happens with Ireland is that Ireland does not become an industrial Protestant print-oriented bourgeois nation-state. It becomes a backwater country, and yet in its failure to industrialize, it becomes the underbelly of the British Empire, where all the economic contradictions of the Third World can be seen in the 19th century. So if you want to understand messianic movements, if you want to understand romantic nationalism, if you want to understand the impact of a modernizing, industrializing nation upon a traditional backward country, you don't have to go around the world in the 20th century to look for examples. You can see it occurring as early as the 19th century in Ireland. So Ireland, in this sense, becomes the test case for a lot of contemporary ideas, and many of our, indeed, revolutionary ideas, such as civil rights and some of the techniques of Martin Luther King, are first tested out in Ireland in the middle of the 19th century. So as with Ireland being the opposite of England, it still, in a sense, is not truly feudal in the classical medieval sense, because the modern world system had been several centuries of mourning. And what Edgeworth is showing is how the aristocracy themselves are doing themselves in and are failing, and that the failure of the feudal order is coming from the failure of nerve and imagination and intelligence of the aristocrats themselves. Now, in this sense, the novel, in the sense that it's about classes, gives you a very interesting sociological analysis of class consciousness. So that what we have, say, with the portrait of the aristocrat is somewhat related to Maria Edgeworth's own father, Richard Lovell Edgeworth, who was himself very much the gentleman of the Enlightenment. And the portrait of what the Enlightenment gentleman should be doing to modernize his estates and to bring the best thought possible around. To Richard Lovell Edgeworth, life presented a number of problems, but few mysteries. Although officially a Protestant, an important circumstance in Ireland, he cannot be called a religious man. Lacking spiritual depth, his mind turned to other problems than those of faith. He made clocks, he invented a sailing carriage, patented a signaling apparatus, which he called a telegraph, tried to construct a wooden horse that would jump over stone walls, built a new spire for the village church, and had it hauled to the top of the tower by rope and pulley while one of his sons played a bugle. Is regarded by some people as the father of modern road making, and filled his house at Edgeworth Town with gadgets and contrivances, so that for decades after his death, unwary guests were trapped in their rooms by complex locks that only members of the family knew how to deal with. And very Protestant, very much concerned with gadgets, with instruments, with technology, and with the whole hope that somehow or other an improvement meant the shift from animal to machine. And if you could build a wooden horse that could jump over a stone fence, it was better than riding a horse of flesh and blood. Now, when you see that, so that's one kind of portrait of the aristocrat in the big house. When you come to the vision of, say, Sir Kit in the novel, you get the classical portrait of the 18th century rake. Taddy is there as Sir Kit comes in. But one morning my new master caught a glimpse of me as I was looking at his horse's heels, in hopes of a word from him. "And is that old Taddy?" says he, as he got into his gig. I loved him from that day to this, his voice was so like the family. And he threw me a guinea out of his waistcoat pocket as he drew up the reins with the other hand, his horse rearing too. I thought I never set my eyes on a finer figure of a man. So here's the whole sense of the aristocrat with the horse reining, and he flings him a guinea. And there's the whole sense of the profligate and how he loves, and all the vices are somehow mythologized into exciting virtues. So what we see with Taddy in his view of Sir Kit is the peasant's respect for the qualities, prodigality. The more he gives away and the more he flings his money, the more he's appreciated. Now this concept really is a very ancient concept, and it's not so much Stone Age economics as it is Neolithic economics, not Old Stone Age economics. It's the idea that you see in Beowulf, where the whole idea of the lord or the leader is the man who must give things away, and that in the giving of gifts, a sacred kind of exchange is made between vassal and lord. So it's always, O giver of gold, O giver of treasure. And this is always used as a kind of celebrative epithet to the description of a man in the warrior society. So that you maintain your power by giving it away, ironically. Of course, there's always left, you know, enough left over for you. And somehow, if the more you give it away, the more you will get. Now, of course, you know, as Tim is smiling, this is the way Irish politics works in Philadelphia. And the more you give away offices, and the more you reinforce your power. And so it's the whole favoritism system, and it's what keeps getting Mayor Daley elected over and over again. But it's easy to see the offensiveness of it to the Boston Brahmins, who think Protestantly in terms of the abstract law and duty and justice. I mean, think of Elliot Richardson and his whole kind of attorney general vision of the law written in mosaically on the tablets on the mountain. And not to realize that there is a more complex sociology going on in this vision, that it's a very human relationship, it's an exchange of energies, it's a kind of reintroduction of the sacred web of interrelatedness that had gone out in industrialization, so that part of the role of the party in American Irish politics is to create an institution of interconnectedness for the poor, who have no other lobbies and have no power. And in many ways, as some historians have pointed out, the party was a way of distributing goods and services into poor neighborhoods and ghettos that worked reasonably effectively, even though it was corrupt. But the corruption misunderstands the aspect of this pre-industrial worldview that still lingers on in primitive places like Philadelphia. Now, this isn't only, of course, with the Irish. If you think of Father Devine or Adam Clayton Powell, who was celebrated because he had $500 suits and $300 alligator shoes, and what's the chap who just passed away, Elijah Muhammad. This is a system of many pre-industrial people who move into industrial circumstances. It was certainly true if you go to Canada. If you compare Quebec with Ontario, Ontario is industrial and ordered and Protestant and anal, and Quebec is just the opposite. It's sloppy and messy, and it's involved in incredible amounts of corruption that always offend the Protestants. The Duplessis regime in Quebec was the most incredibly corrupt government that Canada has ever seen. And so there's a way in which these pre-industrial values linger on into industrial society and have a very studied and thriving life. And once again, the middle-class Protestant sobriety and reinforcement of the law misses the point of what's really going on. So the vision you have in the novel of the rake is very much the sense that he's good because he is a rake, and his prodigality is all the more appreciated. When you come down to from the aristocrat to the middleman with Jason Quirk, you see a different kind of man, not flinging a gold coin to the peasant, but driving a hard bargain. Whilst this was going on, my son requiring to be paid for his trouble, and many years' service in the family gratis, and Sir Condy not willing to take his affairs into his own hands, or to look them even in the face, he gave my son a bargain of some acres which fell out of lease at a reasonable rent. Jason set the land as soon as his lease was sealed to under tenants to make the rent and got $200 a year profit. So what you have is middleman upon middleman. He gets some land, he immediately turns it into a profit and sends it out to rent, so it's renters paying rent to the renters who are paying rent to the absentee landlord in London or in Bath. And the image we have of Jason Kirk is the peasant on the make who's becoming a lawyer, and he's driving a hard bargain with a sack of gold between the deathbeds of Lady Rackrent and Sir Condy. And so Maria Edgeworth's aristocratic vision of this grasping, covetous peasant is one of aristocratic distaste and revulsion for his vulgarity. What you have with Sir Condy is in a way another vision, another archetype, an archetype that will linger, is the extravagant and bankrupt prince. The man is all heart, and he would spend his last dollar, and he has no sense for cash or the head or any kind of thing. He just gives it away, even though in giving away he's just totally incompetent, totally fey, totally Irish. And so Sir Condy is the poetic image of the fallen kings of Ireland. Notice how you get that refrain, the family goes back to Murdoch, who were the blood of kings in their veins. And of course, all peasants would reinforce the sense that though they were peasants, the blood of kings flowed in their veins, because in Ireland, king just meant robber baron or chief or big mucky muck for an area of 10 acres. So that all Ireland, of course, every Irishman is descended from a king. Now what you have in this extravagant and bankrupt prince, his extravagance is really the decayed form of the medieval and archaic ritual of giver of gold, bearer of rings. And it's a kind of selflessness by which the individual ego is related to the fullness of the community, and the flow of gold and energy through the community is what the lifeblood is all about. So gold isn't seen as abstract gold, especially if you read Beowulf. Gold is seen as a magical metal. It has spiritual power. It has mana. And it is so sacred that it is the perfect kind of receptor of psychic energy to be passed around the community and to bind them together into one whole of caring and sharing. So when we come down from, say, the extravagant and bankrupt prince and the grasping middleman, we come to the bottom, we come to the peasant, Taddy Kirk. Now, the interesting thing about Maria Edgeworth's technique in the novel is she presents the point of view through Taddy instead of herself or author's omniscient point of view. And we get the idea of the kind of lovely ironic tension between Maria Edgeworth and Taddy herself. This is a technique that Hermann Hesse uses in Magister Ludi when he's having the kind of dull, pedantic scholar write the history of Knecht. And you have this whole kind of tension between how could he really fully understand the complexity of the master of the bead game. So here you have the whole sense that the society is being seen in the mind of the peasant, and this lets us see a whole world above him and in a sense a whole world below with the lower servants. And there's a kind of, in the peasant's worldview, there's a sort of tragic sense of whimsy that the world is passing and then lesser men are coming in and they're not like they were in the old days, and that the novel is a kind of progression from the man who dies of a drunken fit down to the absentee landlord, and then finally Sir Condy, who again is seen as the alcoholic, and we have this other pattern of the role of alcoholism in Ireland. And again, alcohol in Ireland has to be seen in precisely the same anthropological way you would see corruption in Philadelphia. Uishkabaw in Gaelic means water of life. When Finnegan is dead, they sprinkle water on him and he springs into life and rises up and says, "Thundering Jesus, do you think I'm dead?" So that this is exactly that incredibly ancient archetypal motif that I showed you back in October. When Inanna in ancient Sumer dies and is hung on a nail in hell, they sprinkle the water of life onto her and she rises and she returns to earth. So Uishkabaw is seen as a kind of sacred substance. It's the water of life that takes you into divine consciousness, and it takes you out of your mind, and that's a better place in Ireland to be than in Ireland. And so it has a very sacred function, even though it's a kind of demonic expression of the sacred. So the whole society is disintegrating, and alcoholism is taking over the country, and responsibility is going, and everything is tragedy. And so there's a kind of whimsical sense in Taddy that, from what he's seen of the world and the kind of grasping, covetous middle-class types that are coming in, that he doesn't want any part of it. Let's see if I can find the quote. Pretty much, he says, from what I've seen of the world and the pain in it, I don't want any more of it. Yes, uh-huh. For my part, I'm tired wishing for anything in this world after all I've seen in it. So the sense of the heart and the failure of the heart, the success of the mind, the success of rational man, the success of England and the failure of Ireland is the failure of the heart and the triumph of the mind. And the mind triumphs at the cost of the heart and at the cost of the body. So there's a sense in Taddy that what counts can't be counted, and lesser men are coming in with their cash registers and putting price tags on everything. Now that's the way of the modern world, then to hell with it. So that there's a whole sense of rejection of modernization, rejection of industrialization, rejection of the Protestant ethic. And in point of fact, this is going to become the dominant motif of writers all through the modern industrial world, whether it's Ezra Pound moving into fanciful economics, or it's Yeats or Conrad or Faulkner or whomever. Most of the dominant great voices in the 20th century are conservative, anti-industrial voices, and they are not attacking society from the left, with few exceptions like Orwell. They're attacking from the right, like Lawrence and Pound. So what you have in Taddy is the peasant's rejection of the modern world, and humor becomes the defense of the powerless. The Irish are too shiftless and lazy and charming, and they could never really be given independence. They have no sense of money and markets, and you couldn't trust the modern world with them at all. And their culture is absolutely opposed to it. There's a very fascinating footnote at the end of the novel in which Maria Edgeworth brings up something that really is very basic. It's a fine piece of anthropology that's showing how the Irish really are unfit for the modern world. The English reader may perhaps be surprised at the extent of Taddy's legal knowledge and at the fluency with which he pours forth law terms. But almost every poor man in Ireland, be he farmer, weaver, shopkeeper, or steward, is, beside his other occupations, occasionally a lawyer. The nature of processes, ejectments, custodians, injunctions, replevins, etc., etc., are perfectly known to them, and the terms are as familiar to them as any attorney. They all love law, but know it as oral law. It is a kind of lottery in which every man, staking his own wit or cutting against his richer neighbor's property, feels that he has little to lose and much to gain. "I'll have the law of you, so I will," is the saying of an Englishman who expects justice. "I'll have you before..." No, sorry, I should say, "I'll have the law of you, so I will," is the saying of an Englishman who expects justice. "I'll have you before his honor," is the threat of an Irishman who hopes for partiality. Miserable is the life of a justice of the peace in Ireland the day after a fair, especially if he resides near a small town. The multitude of the kilt does not mean killed, but hurt, and wounded who come before his honor with black eyes or bloody heads is astonishing. But more astonishing is the number of those who, though they are scarcely able by daily labor to procure daily food, will nevertheless, without the least reluctance, waste 6 or 7 hours of the day lounging in the yard or a hall of a justice of the peace, waiting to make some complaint about nothing. It is impossible to convince them that time is money. Now that's the fascinating thing about the shift in the consciousness of time, the shift in the consciousness of nature. You should think of the writings of Benjamin Lee Whorf in this context about what he said about the ideas of time among the American Indian, especially the Hopi. And Lewis Mumford, in his book Technics and Civilization, says that the origins of mechanization are to be seen in the mechanization of time, which was introduced by the clocks and were introduced first by the monasteries. They do not set any value upon their own time, and they think that others estimate theirs at less than nothing. Hence, they make no scruple of telling a justice of the peace a story of an hour long about a tester, sixpence, and if he grows impatient, they attribute it to some secret prejudice which he entertains against them. Their method is to get a story completely by heart and to tell it, as they call it, out of the face. That is, from beginning to the end without interruption. And so she gives a little scene. "Well, my good friend, I have seen you lounging about these 3 hours in the yard. What is your business?" "Please, Your Honor, it is what I want to speak. One word to Your Honor." "Speak then, but be quick. What is the matter?" "Nothing strange. The matter, please, Your Honor, is nothing at all. Only just about the grays, and of course, please, Your Honor, that this man here sold me at the fair of Gertshun in La Shrove Fair, which laid down three times with meself, please, Your Honor, and killed me. Not to be telling Your Honor of how, no later back than yesterday night, he lay down in the house there within, and all the children standing round. It was God's mercy he did not fall atop of them, or into the fire to burn himself, so please, Your Honor. Today I took him back to this man, which owned him, and after a great deal to do, I got the mare again. I swapped him for, but he won't pay the grazing of the horse by the time I had him, though he promised to be pay the grazing in the case the horse didn't answer, and he never did a day's work, good or bad, please Your Honor, all the time he was with me, and I had the doctor to him five times anyhow, and so, please Your Honor, it is what I expect Your Honor will stand me, friend, for I'd sooner come to Your Honor for justice than to any other in all Ireland, and so I brought him here with Your Honor, and expect Your Honor will make him pay me for the grazing, or tell me, can I process him for it the next assizes, please Your Honor, and on it goes. So the fascinating aspect is the emphasis on oral culture, the emphasis on face-to-face relationships in which the law is embodied in Your Honor, and the way in which the oral culture re-emphasizes the quality that time is dynamic, is fluid, is sensuous, is palpable, and is not an abstract kind of entity. Now, in Language, Thought, and Reality, Benjamin Lee Whorf talks about the peculiarity we have in spatializing time, that we say, I have 6 days in front of me before I go on vacation. And we line up days as if there were so many apples. And the spatialization of time begins to affect the way we begin to act and behave and experience time. It subtly changes the whole quality of our modality. If you look at the poem, basically medieval, Summer Is A-Coming In, the whole sense is time is sensuous, and it's punctuated by the natural clock of the flower and the seasons and the animals, but it's not so much an entity of intense agony, or this whole sense that you get a little later in the Renaissance of memento mori and carpe diem, and the time is moving and the world is changing. In many ways, I suppose you could say that the idea of seize the day, carpe diem, which is so important in late 16th century poetry, is probably related to this whole shift from one culture to another and the way in which the emergence of the modern world system is coming on and is transforming consciousness. So the oral culture is really, in a sense, the eternal now, and time has a much more palpable quality. Protestant print culture is a world of sequential words and clock time. Time is money, a quantity, you can count it. And the peculiarity it generates is one destroys his life to have a bank balance. And so you see this whole paradox of people getting so grasping and so covetous that they're not at all concerned with what it does to their body, what it does to their family, what it does to themselves. They begin to worry and worry and worry and worry and accumulate and utterly destroy their life just so that somehow these abstract numbers get bigger and bigger and bigger. And one is happier with $200,000 than he would be with $100,000, but he never begins to think at all about the quality of life. This is why now ecologists are having a hell of a time trying to re-educate the entire modern world to think in terms of the quality of life rather than the gross national product. And it just simply isn't getting into the heads of the economists who stand at the right hand of the president or the president himself, because we've had centuries of this indoctrination. So what happens when you look at the whole novel, it's a fascinating document of the shift of one world to another, the cost that this world extracted from us in coming in, and the way in which the price was paid in Ireland, and in fact is still going on, as a literary work, as opposed to a historical document, it really is looking forward to a whole set of novels about the collision of opposed cultures, the collision of industrial and rural cultures. And in the kind of geography of the novel, of the peasant's hut and the big house of the lord, it of course is the archetype of what will become the southern novel, and it will dominate the imagination of a whole host of American writers, and of course be consummately expressed in the work of Faulkner. As a matter of fact, if you read Maria Edgeworth with a mind to the work of William Faulkner, you'll see how profoundly influential it is. So that as a literary document, it's really very important, but also as a way of understanding the modern world, it shows the kind of ruthless collision of opposed values and what happens when a pre-industrial culture collides with an industrial one, whether it's Ulster and Southern Ireland or Quebec in English Canada. Now let's have tea.